History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. In the early years of the 20th century, the most famous Americans on the national stage were Theodore Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, and Jane Addams. First two are well-known presidents, but the last has been largely forgotten. However, at the time, she was America's most famous woman. Arguably, the only other one was Helen Keller. And she was an important leader in the history of social work and women's suffrage in the United States, and also advocated for world peace, which caused her to fall out of favor during the nationalist fervor of World War I. Each took a different path to prominence, but the three progressives, or progressive in the early 20th century sense, believed the United States had to assume a more dynamic role in confronting the growing domestic and international problems of a completely new era. With the onset of World War I in 1914, the views of these three splintered as they couldn't agree on how America should respond that proved to be one of the biggest global catastrophes in world history. Today I'm speaking with Neil Langto, who's the author of the new book, The Approaching Storm: Roosevelt, Wilson, Adams, and their clash over America's future. We discuss how these three debated, quarreled, and split over what role the United States should play in the world. Now, in some ways, they're creatures of a bygone era. They argued over women's suffrage and whether laborers and workers should have essentially any rights whatsoever. Many of these issues were resolved with the passage of women's suffrage in 1920 and the New Deal in the 1930s. But in other ways, their questions over human rights, peace versus foreign intervention, and other matters are just as relevant today as they were back then. This is an era of incredible transformation in the United States, and I argued in my earlier series with James Early on key battles of World War I that World War I was the key watershed moment in modern history. And in this episode, we really dive into all the changes that happened in a remarkably short amount of time. So I hope you enjoy this discussion with Neil Langto. Neil, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
This period, which your book takes place, is very interesting in the period right up to and including World War I, which I've mentioned in my multi-part series with a co-host on World War I, that in many ways it created the modern world, however many ways that's defined, because it really does seem like a watershed where after World War I, historical figures seem more recognizable. But before then, in many ways, it can appear like a lost age where on the good side of things, there are Edwardian manners, there's this noblesse oblige among the upper class, ideas of virtue and chivalry like you see with people going down with the Titanic. On the downside, there are commonly held views that can seem horrifying, to say nothing of racism, ideas like eugenics and prominent Americans taking part in eugenics conferences. So to set the stage for the discussion of your book, from a 30,000-foot view, what were the worries and concerns that people had in the United States prior to World War I, and what were some of the different solutions being offered at this time?
Well, the book begins in 1912 with the Progressive Convention, where you have Jane Addams, one of the three characters in the book, main characters in the book, nominating Theodore Roosevelt, ex-president, to be the standard bearer of this new party, the Progressive Party. And that's where the country is in 1912, 1913, 1914. It's progressive. Progressivism is a big part of the scene. Reform is in the air. And the progressive movement itself had emerged in the prior 20 years as a result from all these changes in America, all these immigrants coming to the country, and can they be Americanized? We have to figure out a way to Americanize them. Then you have these giant corporations, which are getting bigger and bigger and more threatening and changing the country, whether it's a land of opportunity anymore. So it's an era where everyone's taking a hard look at what direction the country's going and trying to propose solutions. And that's what the progressive movement is all about. And progressivism is kind of a hard thing to wrap your head around because it encompasses many, many different kinds of reform movements. Eugenics to some people was a progressive reform at the time. Of course, today we would be horrified by it, but it was in the reform camp. Prohibition to some people was a reform. But then you had things like ending child labor, more popular participation in the government. So it's all kinds of different reforms, all kinds of different people supporting these reforms, and it cuts across both parties. So there's progressive Democrats and progressive Republicans. And Theodore Roosevelt was leaning progressive. He had been a former president. He had been president. And when the Republican establishment would not nominate him in 1912. He broke apart to establish this new party, Progressive Party. And there's a quote in the book where William Jennings Bryan, who was the great Democratic leader, the great commoner, as they called him, said at the time of the 1912 election, something like 9/10 of the country is progressive, which was some exaggeration, but I think the country was definitely moving towards reforms and changes and moving the country into a whole new direction. The war, however, World War I in 1914 changes everything and I think arrests and slows down the progressive movement in the United States. So that sets the stage for where the country is circa 1914.
And it's an interesting period because although my specific research field is quite different, the Ottoman Empire, it's during this period, and I've looked at Americans who were there, many of which were Protestant missionaries who were very progressive and some of the elites of the United States in many senses and had incredible optimism of the future that education levels and scientific research is all rising concomitant with the spread of Christianity. So they had their own view of progressivism, which is interestingly shared much with President Wilson and also William Jennings Bryan, both two very devout men. But one point before drilling down into them specifically, can you talk a little bit more about progressivism and when it really reaches its high water mark in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, what is it rising in response to? What are the troubles in the United States that it seems to be addressing? Because I think this helps us understand the solutions that are being offered by Wilson and others that can, in some senses, seem a little bit strange to us today.
Well, for Roosevelt, people often suggested that Roosevelt was sort of threatened from below. In other words, the working class moving too far to the left, because, of course, there's great labor strife during this time, and these great corporations and the labor men are trying to fight for their share. The fear that they may turn to socialists. We got to give them a bigger piece of the pie. And then from the top is, again, the super rich, these incredibly wealthy people and powerful people in American society who had not existed 50, 60, 70 years ago. And because of the whole industrialization of America, you have these really powerful mega corporations, which seem to have so much influence in the country and so much influence politically in the country. So that's part of the reason also. And then again, the immigrant thing I alluded to earlier, the fear that immigrants are coming over, they're not being Americanized, they'll be manipulated by one or the other political party. So therefore, we have to make sure we can enlarge political participation so the best people are elected and things like that. So is that all these cross currents are going on at this time in America. Of the three principals of this book, Wilson, Roosevelt, and Jane Addams, who we haven't mentioned yet, Jane Addams is probably the most progressive of the three. She was on the forefront of basically every reform movement of that period, and she certainly was the most progressive when it came to racial issues. Wilson, of course, was the worst in that regard. Roosevelt was so-so, better than Wilson. But someone like Jane Addams was involved in the NAACP is something that really set her apart from a lot of her contemporaries.
Yeah, I mean, that's all very interesting. And then others who wouldn't fall into this progressive camp, like a William Howard Taft, sometimes they're interpreted as almost a throwback, that they're a traditionalist conservative, like practically a Jeffersonian hanging on from the 19th century. Do you think that's a fair characterization? Or are others just simply saying, well, we don't need to reform, we don't need to increase labor standards, let's just not really create any sort of laws that aren't enumerated by the Constitution? Or is it more than that among the more traditionalist camp?
Yeah, in both parties, you had conservatives. I mean, Republicans, you had the old guard, what we call the old guard Republicans, someone like Taft. And the interesting thing is that when Roosevelt basically picked Taft to be a successor and then got very mad when Taft didn't follow his policies, Taft proved to be a lot more conservative than Roosevelt ever thought he was going to be. And just to give you an indication of Taft's conservatism, he was someone who was against women's suffrage. He basically said, if we allow women to vote, it will increase the hysterical element of the voting, and we don't want to do that. So Taft was a conservative, you know, from that class. And then in the Democratic Party, you have Southerners, certain Southern Democrats who were not particularly progressive, and certainly very, very unprogressive when it came to the racial issue. So, you know, America then and now is a giant country with many different perspectives. And that's one thing I tried to bring out in this book when it comes to the decision about us going to war. There was great difference in opinion just from region to region. You know, the East Coast was certainly much more pro-intervention, much more connected to Great Britain. The Midwest was fairly ambivalent. And by the time you get to the West Coast, they almost felt no connection to the war. So there was a great deal of difficulty of people for there to be a consensus in this country when it came to decisions like going to war or how involved should we be in this great conflict.
Well, I suppose we should dive into these different figures. And let's begin with Roosevelt, since he achieves national prominence before Wilson does. So in this period, tell us about his background, his ideology, what he conceives to be the problems coming and the solutions that he offers.
Well, of course, Roosevelt had been a figure on the American scene for a long time before the war. You know, he grew up in privilege in New York and started out as basically a rich kid's son, goes to Harvard, decides he might become a lawyer, decides he doesn't like law school, gets into politics, and from there he rises up the ladder and becomes famous, of course, with participating in the Spanish-American War with the Rough Riders. That really puts his name on the map. He then eventually gets picked to be William McKinley's running mate in 1900. And when McKinley gets assassinated, suddenly Roosevelt is president of the United States, the youngest president ever. And Roosevelt in office, of course, is going to be a very compelling figure, very dominating figure, someone who believed in using the bully pulpit. He believes in an expanded role for the United States abroad. He also believes in what he calls the square deal, as far as a willingness to intervene and to prosecute the abuses of corporations. Roosevelt, however, is a celebrity, and he's someone who the public is fascinated by. He's someone who's never at a loss for words. He loves the attention. He loves being president. And he's just a very colorful individual who just about a great deal of the public absolutely adores when he's in office. And he's just such a fascinating figure and so recognizable and basically a publicist's dream. His years outside the White House, however, see him in decline as far as his influence. He leaves the White House in 1909. He thinks he's leaving the White House in good hands of his friend William Howard Taft. Taft doesn't work out. Roosevelt decides he wants to be president again, but the Republicans say, we're not going to kick Taft out in 1912. And then Roosevelt breaks away to start this whole new party, the Progressive Party, which it actually is a miracle in itself. He gets this party off the ground fairly quickly and gets a sizable number of votes in 1912 as a third party candidate. He actually finishes ahead of Taft in 1912, which is remarkable, but he's beaten. By 1914, he feels his popularity is waning. He feels that people are not listening to him anymore. They think he's just someone who's greedy for power. He's going to get sued. He's going to be in a libel suit. And worst of all, the man in the White House, Woodrow Wilson, is a man he absolutely detests with every fiber of his being. And that's a big part of this book, is this feud and dislike between these two giants, Wilson and Roosevelt.
Well, that's a good point to mention this. I was going to ask about Adams because she speaks with the nomination of Roosevelt. But first of all, why did Wilson and Roosevelt dislike each other so much? I mean, temperamentally, they're about as opposite as you could possibly find. But was this the primary reason? Were there other reasons?
Well, they started out as being fairly friendly to one another. In fact, when Roosevelt was in the White House, he invited Wilson to come visit. Wilson at that time was president of Princeton. Wilson begged off. His father had just died. But I mean, they were fairly collegial, I guess, to use the academic word. You know, they exchanged a few letters, and Roosevelt was kind of glad when Wilson was made president of Princeton. But then I think they began to disagree politically. They disagreed about the matters of trust busting, where someone like Wilson thought that the big corporations could be broken up permanently. Someone like Roosevelt felt we should just punish bad behavior of the corporations, not necessarily their bigness. So they disagreed on that. And then I think, as you mentioned, temperamentally, they were so different. I mean, Roosevelt was obsessed with manhood, obsessed with participating in the military, firing guns, hunting, things like that, where Wilson was nothing like that. On the other hand, they both had intellect in common. They're both probably two of our brainiest presidents, too. Roosevelt was so well informed, had almost a photographic memory. There's a quote in the book where I mentioned how Roosevelt could remember the words on the page and where they were arranged. I mean, he had an incredible memory, knew something about everything. And Wilson, too. Of course, Wilson was a very, very intelligent man. He had the academic credentials that Roosevelt did not have. Wilson had a PhD, but also someone who was, you know, there's contemporary writers talking about the two men and saying one thing about Wilson, he immediately jumps on an idea, absorbs it, makes it his own, and can understand it so quickly. Both of them were just very, very smart guys. So they had that in common. And then you throw Jane Addams in the mix, too. Addams was also a remarkably well-read, intelligent woman who, again, was someone who was so respected for her ability to understand complex issues and distill them in her writing. So all of them were also very accomplished writers, wrote many books, wrote for the newspapers and the magazines of the day. So they were figures who were extremely adept in a number of fields, but their intellectual equipment was remarkable.
Well, this is a good point to talk about Addams, where other reforms that Roosevelt or Wilson would consider as necessary or as potentially damaging women's suffrage, he would consider as a linchpin toward the overall promise of the Constitution and human rights in the United States. So tell me about her and how she agrees and then also disagrees and also stands on her own completely from Roosevelt and Wilson.
Well, Addams is interesting because she's the least well-known of the three. She shouldn't be. I hope this book does give her a little more ink. At the time, she was very well known. She was probably the most famous woman in America in the early 1900s, maybe with the possible exception of Helen Keller. Those would be the two biggies that everyone would know. But Addams was, again, someone who grew up in privilege, but developed a social conscience. And she was someone who was, again, very, very smart. The opportunities for women were limited in the Victorian era. She thought about becoming a doctor. That didn't really float her boat in the long run. And she eventually got drawn to what's called the settlement house movement. These settlement houses were established in Europe and also the United States. They would be placed in typically poor communities, or they would be located in poor communities. And typically middle-class men and women would go live in these settlement houses and sort of minister to the people living in the communities. They would act as almost crude social service agencies. And in some ways, that was the beginning of the progressive movement, you know, working, you know, practicing what you preach, working among the poor, trying to alleviate their suffering. Addams established Hull House in Chicago, and that's what put her on the map. That she and her friend established that in the 1880s. Hull House became a huge success. Everyone wanted to write about it. From there, she got into more and more liberal causes. And by the early 1900s, as I mentioned, she was one of the most well-known people in the United States, women in the United States. She had her finger in a lot of pies. Pacifism was one of them. She wrote about pacifism before the war. And suffrage was also one of her main issues. She was a big part of this movement to get women the vote, which was making some inroads in the early 1900s, but not as fast as what a lot of people wanted. A lot of suffragists believed that a federal amendment was needed instead of trying to do state by state, which was what was happening at the time. And that was a very big struggle to get. A lot of states were still voting against it. Roosevelt at one point was like, eh, it's not that important. But he was converted by Jane Addams, I think, to say, yes, suffrage, I'm for the suffrage amendment. Wilson said it's a state issue. So he would not come out until much later for a federal suffrage amendment.
Right. There's a lot of interesting other figures in your book that I think stand out because these are issues that suffrage is not a political issue anymore in the United States, nor has it been for a century, but was very important. So there were political alignments because of this that existed in interesting ways. And can you talk about some of the other figures in your book outside of these three? Two that stuck out to me were Rosika Schwimmer and William Monroe Trotter.
We'll talk about Schwimmer first. Schwimmer was this Hungarian woman who was just she was way ahead of her time. She was a remarkable figure. She was involved in the suffrage camp. And at the beginning of the war, she was in England. And since of course, England's going to be going to war with Austria-Hungary, she's going to have to leave the country. So she comes to America in the fall of 1914 at the invitation of the suffrage crowd because she was so involved in suffrage. But really, her issue was pacifism and peace. And she believes that we have to find a way to end the slaughter. And she is the word obsessed, and perhaps in a good way, but she is obsessed with trying to find a way to end the war. So she comes here in 1914, in the fall of 1914, immediately gets in to see Wilson, which is unbelievable. But I mentioned this in the book. In those days, the White House was much more open to visitors. It wasn't that hard for someone, not off the street, but someone could probably write to the president's secretary or call the president's secretary and say, can I see the president today? And they'll say, okay, come next week. It was not that hard to get in to see people. And Wilson would devote a certain amount of his time to visitors. Schwimmer, of course, knew Adams, and Schwimmer's going to kind of push Adams more and more and push the entire American peace movement in a much more aggressive direction. So she's going to be, throughout this book, the kind of the radical wing, represent the radical wing of the pacifist movement. She is going to push for the women delegates to the Peace Congress at The Hague in 1915 to send representatives to the heads of the warring powers. And Adams will be one of these representatives, and she will go to England, and she'll go to Germany, and she'll go to France, and she will actually get audiences with the heads of state to talk about ways to find a way out of the war. So it's remarkable. I mean, Adams is a big part of this, what we call citizen diplomacy. But Schwimmer, as I mentioned, is a real dynamo. Who she's a feminist, and she's ahead of her time in so many ways. It's a figure we don't know that much about, but I think she deserves to be also more well known.
Right. I mean, as an aside, she's described as a militant feminist and hardcore atheist and radical advocate for peace, which for descriptors like that, many assume that that really only comes out in the 1960s or 1970s when some activists become more militant in promoting their different causes. Was a figure like this, I don't want to say common in the 1910s, but a figure that you could find attached to different movements?
I think she was an exception. I think she was, and she was even too much for some people. And Adams was like, you know, I think Adams' view was she could be an extremist, but I think she does good. She was always willing to hear her side and listen to her and take some of her suggestions. Though there are other women in the peace movement who felt that Schwimmer was just too much, too one note. They thought it was crazy for her to try to end this war, and that the biggest thing should be try to create some infrastructure so we could prevent future wars. Where Schwimmer was like, stop the war now. We have to stop the war now. We have to find a way. And that the belief was this was not realistic, but we should try to, again, create something for the future to prevent these kind of wars from happening. She was very emotional, and that also annoyed some of the American women. They felt also that she often was too much trying to get credit all the time. But again, Adams' view was, I'll try anything, because Adams believed that something had to be done to stop the slaughter. For Adams, her big hope was that America would somehow anchor a conference of neutrals, which would somehow bring together the warring powers, get them to at least talk. And if they start talking, maybe there'll be a ceasefire, maybe we can get the war ended. But she pushes and pushes this, pushes Wilson for this for 2 years. Wilson never does go for it, but that's something that she works towards, and Schwimmer to a certain degree, although Schwimmer always felt that the peace movement itself was too docile and not aggressive enough.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Another person, William Monroe Trotter, I think he exposes the divisions on approaching race among these different politicians, where Theodore Roosevelt, interestingly enough, received criticism for having Booker T. Washington for dinner at the White House. And I read an account that many people, their problem wasn't that he came to the White House, but that he dined with the president. That in that society was apparently the sticking point. Wilson famously segregates different federal branches. So can you talk about Trotter and then the different approaches to race that these three figures have?
Yeah, Trotter is mentioned in this book in the fall of 1914, which is a very difficult time for Wilson. Wilson's wife had just died. She died at the very beginning of the war. And he's having a terrible time of it. In fact, there's a scene in the book where Wilson is walking through the streets of New York with his advisor, Colonel Edward House. And House, who kept this elaborate diary for years, House wrote in his diary that the president said to me, he'd be happy if someone shot him right now. But since no one will, he'll keep doing the work that has to be done, but he would like to die. I mean, like, Wilson's almost having a nervous breakdown. In the midst of this, Trotter comes to the White House. Trotter was an editor for a Boston African-American newspaper, and he comes to talk to Wilson about the segregation that's going on in the federal government. And what's interesting is that this entire conversation was transcribed. There was a stenographer present who took it all down, and then later it was written up. And you see this very charged conversation occurring between these two men. And it's very unlike Wilson, as I mentioned in the book, because Wilson was someone who believed he was Mr. Self-Mastery. Don't lose control of yourself. So he does lose control with this conversation with Trotter. Trotter tries to explain to him, look, segregation is going on in the government that did not occur in the past. You know, why is this happening? This is not a good thing. And Wilson just cannot understand. He just like you know, we're avoiding friction, and my colleagues, meaning his cabinet colleagues, believe this is the best thing to do. And Trotter tries to educate them. It's very interesting. Trotter's like saying, don't you understand that by separating us like this, you're saying that we are not your brother, we're not the same as you. And finally, at one point, Wilson basically says, I will never see this group again if you have this man coming, you know, because I've never been talked to by anyone like this again, and blah, 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 blah. And then the Secret Service shows up and they whisk Trotter out the door and the rest of the delegation. It's a really interesting conversation. And it does show where Wilson's head was at. I hesitate to say Wilson was, of course, a racist by 21st century standards. By the standards of the 1910s, he was probably a moderate on racial issues. He was segregationist, obviously, but there were many far worse than him. He was a product of his upbringing. He grew up in the South. That's what he grew up with slaves. He could never see African Americans as being anything but you know, an inferior group of people. I don't think he ever dealt with them on any kind of level of equality in his life, probably. If we move over to Adams, Adams was very different. I mean, Adams was someone who, there's a quote I have in the book where someone talks about, I think it was Adams' niece saying she went to Hull House and was for the first time ever she sat at a table with an African-American woman because her aunt Jane had her at the table. You know, so Jane Adams was someone who dealt with African-Americans on a position of equality. She was involved in the NAACP, which the NAACP was a fairly radical entity at the time. Its existence was a threat to mainstream American values. She was also disgusted by Birth of a Nation. Birth of a Nation, D.W. Griffith's famous film, comes out during this period and is screened at the White House. Jane Adams thought the film was horrible. It was awful. It was a disgrace. It was manipulative and, you know, speaks out against it. Contrary to popular belief, Wilson never actually endorsed it. It's doubtful that he disagreed with the contents of it because it was, of course, a very racist depiction of Reconstruction. Roosevelt, I think Roosevelt was a little more enlightened than Wilson, but I don't think racial issues was ever an important thing. He was involved with Booker T. Washington and Tuskegee, which was the more moderate side of the civil rights movement, such as it was at the time. Certainly more than Wilson probably would have done. But there's a quote I have in the book where Roosevelt's talking to his friend, Henry Cabot Lodge, about voting in the South. And Roosevelt says something like, well, we really can't have the black vote in the South right now, because if we do, it will reduce parts of the South to peonage. So it's almost like he felt that African Americans in the South were still not ready for the vote as of yet. So again, that kind of shows you where he was as far as politically. Now, his son actually, just a quick digression, his son, Ted Jr., was actually fairly advanced in his racial views.
Right. It's to expect Roosevelt to be 21st century. I mean, he has somewhat of a paternalistic view toward non-white Americans. So it's always good to keep that context in mind. Well, for these three and their views, when World War I comes along, wartime is always very fascinating because it's the opportunity for decades of conventional wisdom to be challenged, sometimes validated, sometimes completely discarded. We see this obviously in military tactics, where generals will plan using tactics from the last war. They'll famously get destroyed and have to rapidly innovate. So in the case of World War II, the conventional wisdom is naval warfare is built around battleships, and we see the aircraft carriers are actually the way to go. But we also see social conventions being radically challenged, where women for a period of time could receive rights and responsibilities they didn't previously have because there's simply too great of a manpower shortage. And when they're expected to revert back to their previous role, that plants the seeds of future reforms to come along. So for these three, the views that they have when they really come up against World War I, who fares the best and who fares the worst?
As far as the views they had coming into the war?
Yes.
And are we talking internationally, foreign affairs, foreign relations, or?
Both, you could say.
I think Wilson's views probably evolved the most in a number of different areas. I think when the war began, Wilson's views as far as military preparedness changed a great deal. At the beginning of the war, Wilson, I think, and much of the country believed that our little measly 100,000-man army was plenty. We didn't need more than that. In fact, very early in the war, when there is some talk on Capitol Hill to let's start talking about quote-unquote preparedness, let's start trying to build up our military, our armed forces in particular, Wilson pretty much squelches that. It's not until the sinking of the Lusitania and suddenly this feeling in America that maybe we're not so safe after all, we have to start thinking about protecting ourselves, and also this connection between military strength and the ability to accomplish anything globally. I think Roosevelt understood that early on, and he made this point, something like, if we as the United States want to be in a position to do good and sort of smite wrongdoers, so to speak, around the globe, we have to have the military apparatus in place. Talk, it means nothing. You know, if we, and also when it comes to the war, the same thing. Wilson had this idea that he at some point would be able to help bring the war to an end, somehow bring the combatants together, maybe even be a mediator. But Roosevelt said again, America will be nothing but a kind of a fetch and carry between the militants unless we participate in the war or do something in the war or have the oomph to make our presence known. They're not going to turn to the United States simply because we have good intentions. We have to have something to back that up. And I think Roosevelt and Wilson came to grasp that later on. And it's interesting, and we're jumping ahead to after the war, which I don't really cover that much in this book, we'll talk about briefly. Wilson at Versailles has obviously difficulty getting his program across, but it's been said that if the war had gone on longer, if the war had not ended in November 1918 and had gone into 1919, the number of Americans in Europe in the armed forces would have been so huge. It would have been like this like gigantic American army, which was already getting bigger and bigger as the war progressed, that Wilson would have had more say, more power at Versailles if Americans had done more of the fighting and had been more troops on the front lines. And had the war gone longer, that might very well have been the case. So I think that's a very important thing to remember. As for Adams, I think Adams may have learned not to be so trusting. I think she and a lot of the peace forces thought, okay, well, the president of the United States, Woodrow Wilson, is one of us. He is a pacifist. He listens to our conversation. He listens to us. He lets us come to the White House. He writes us letters. He responds to us. In reality, Wilson was a very shrewd guy. He knew that Jane Adams and her supporters were important from a political standpoint, so he was happy to listen to her. But when push came to shove late in the war, late in 1916, 1917, she finally realizes that she and Wilson don't necessarily have the same view about the war. And she's very disenchanted when Wilson takes the country into war because she believes that there were other things that could have been tried, that it was the worst possible decision to make. So I think it was a dose of reality, maybe, as far as what the powers that be, what they really thought of her and what they were willing to do, and that some of them were simply trying to curry favor with her politically.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. I'm interested how you view these three characters and their beliefs after the war. Because for the example with Wilson, he proposes the League of Nations, it fails. His view of a new internationalist world order doesn't work. There's more of an armistice than a peace, which was only resolved at World War II. So in some ways, it's easy to write Wilson off as a failure. So the different views that these three have, are they resolved somehow? And I don't know, the New Deal, tying up some knots with classical progressivism? Do they fall by the wayside? Do they change into something else? So how do you see this era and the ideologies of these three people working out in the long term?
I think definitely the New Deal is sort of the tying up of some of these loose ends. And Roosevelt, the Franklin, not Theodore, certainly owed something to both Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt. In fact, your listeners may not be aware that Franklin Roosevelt was part of Wilson's administration. He was the Assistant Secretary of the Navy. And they didn't necessarily see things the same way at the time. I say Franklin Roosevelt was probably far more on Theodore Roosevelt's side when it came to preparedness. And something I often think about, I don't remember if I got this into the book or not. I think that Franklin Roosevelt learned from some of Woodrow Wilson's mistakes as far as preparation. The United States was much better prepared to go to war in World War II than it was in World War I. I think Franklin Roosevelt had tried to get the country on a wartime footing, you know, 1939, 1940, we go to war in 1941. So we were in better shape. We had a draft in place, remember, in 1940 before we go to war a year later, as opposed to World War I, when suddenly we're involved in the war in April 1917, we have nothing. You know, the country is not really ready to go to war at all. So I do think that's something to consider. For Adams, Adams has a very difficult time after the war. I mean, she's seen as a radical. She's seen as someone who was opposed to the war. And of course, the war itself unleashed this sort of super patriotism. And Adams and any pacifist was seen as being almost a traitor to the state. In the 20s, the FBI is even doing surveillance on her. But I think by the time of the early 30s, with the New Deal and a whole new liberal progressive order coming in, that suddenly there's a great change in the way she's perceived. And she wins the Nobel Peace Prize. So I think there is a sort of a completely reconsideration of her and her contributions. But in the 1920s, she is almost persona non grata and is seen as some kind of threat to the country. Roosevelt, of course, does not live long. I mean, the armistice is November 11th, 1918. Roosevelt goes into the hospital that day, and he dies January 6, 1919. He got out of the hospital shortly at the end of December and then died shortly thereafter. It's interesting to consider what would have happened to Roosevelt had he lived. He had gone back to the Republican Party. He had emerged as the leader. And in an alternate universe, it's possible that Roosevelt lives, Wilson doesn't have a stroke, these two men run against each other in 1920. And again, that would have possibly changed everything. You know, could have changed America's role. Maybe the League of Nations gets approved by the Senate. So there's all kinds of different things that could have happened if, you know, things had gone a different direction.
Why do you think Adams isn't remembered as well as Roosevelt and Wilson?
Well, she's a woman. That'd probably be the first thing to say. I think male historical figures tend to get more ink, to use that term, than women do. Adams very much deserves to be known and deserves to be remembered for really being an important figure. It's interesting that Roosevelt himself said if he had been elected president again, he would have given a cabinet position to Jane Addams. So she would have been the first female cabinet member before Frances Perkins was in the Franklin Roosevelt administration. She was, as I said, many ways ahead of her time in her views. She was ahead of her time, I think, in her pacifist views. But I think what's interesting about her is that she was not afraid to take unpopular stances. I mean, she was someone who was loved by the public before the war. People saw her as like an American saint. I mean, she did Hull House and she does all these do-gooding activities. And she could have rested on her laurels and done that for the rest of her life and just basked in the glow of being the wonderful, selfless American saint. But she got involved in some very radical things that the public did not like. And she was knocked off her pedestal as being this idealized woman, but she didn't care. There's a quote in the book where I have Clarence Darrow, who knew her very well. And Clarence Darrow told Jane Addams' niece that one thing I admire about your aunt is that she has courage. I think that's a good way to look at her. She was a very courageous woman.
Well, I really like examinations of history like this, where different people are wrestling with an issue that we know how it ends. We have the benefit of hindsight, but they're considering all sorts of possibilities that didn't pan out. But it shows us how elastic the issues were at the time, which they always are. So I guess to tie in the different examinations of the things in your book, do you think that the conflict among these three figures is something that was really rooted in its place and time and doesn't have relevance to today? Or are there issues that you can see, the issues among which they're arguing about, do have relevance to other issues that we're experiencing now?
I think American involvement around the globe, I think that's always an issue in American politics. You know, where do we go? What should we do? Where is our responsibility? This was something that was so contested in the first years of the war. You know, people were very upset when the Germans invaded Belgium in 1914. It was very brutal. And there were, you know, people like Roosevelt thought this was absolutely horrendous. The United States should protest against this. But then there were others in the United States, as I mentioned earlier, who said that's unfortunate what happened there, but it's not our business. We can't go around fixing every problem around the globe that not necessarily concern us. And there were people also at the time who said, you know, we sat still while the Japanese, you know, helped themselves to Korea, basically. We didn't do anything for that. So what is our role? Where should we go as a nation? I mean, this is what they're all trying to figure out. And for Jane Addams, her belief was America's role should be to throw our weight on the side for peace, to end this. That's what our role should be. I mean, I think they all envisioned a fairly substantial role for the United States around the world. They were not isolationist. But again, coming back to your point, I think that's always a very timely issue, is what is our position around the globe? How deeply do we get involved? And will the American people stand for our involvement? Even up to the very end, when the United States goes to war in April 1917, many Americans thought that there would never be troops sent, that there'd be no American troops ever sent. That's a preposterous idea. You know, we'll convoy ships for them, or we'll lend them money. We'll keep sending them munitions. But the idea of sending an army across the Atlantic Ocean, that's impossible, never happen. The country won't stand for it. And of course, that's exactly what does happen. So I think these are things that are still relevant to us today in the 21st century. I think another thing that which is interesting is the progressive movement itself and issues that can affect progressivism or reform. You know, suddenly these unseen issues pop up. Progressive movement was riding high up to about 1913, 1914. Suddenly you have a war, and that changes everything. And you could project that into our own time. Who could have predicted that COVID would come along and change everything? I mean, these unforeseen cataclysmic events can completely change the political scene, the political landscape. So I think these are a couple of issues you can look at.
Well, I love the perspective you bring, because of course the issues are different, but as we deal with issues that have some similarity, reasoning by analogy with historical events can allow us to detach from the political moment, which can be very heated, and get insight from other periods. So there's a lot more to this, and there's a lot of other people we weren't able to talk about. And for listeners who want to check out your book, the name is The Approaching Storm, Roosevelt, Wilson, Adams, and Their Clash Over America's Future. Neil, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
All right. That is all for today. If you'd like to see show notes for this episode and all my other episodes, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that this show is a part of, along with other great history shows like Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support this show, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to History Unplugged on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the show's membership program. It's on Patreon, and if you go to patreon.com/unplugged and join it, as a member, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the show's entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.